Michael Nicholson, Reel 3. Yes, you were saying it's very interesting, you know, the difference between ITN and the BBC then. The style, you were saying, was so very different.
Well, the style was different then, and the style is different now. All these years on, the BBC still are still very old-fashioned, and ITN is still, in the way it approaches news and packages the news, is still light years ahead. Being a small organisation, of course, benefited us a great deal, and the editors, the succession of editors, were wise enough and daring enough to allow reporters to have their head. They wouldn't hesitate. I can remember, anecdotal, but the very first flood in Bangladesh was in the late 60s. I remember being, I was a very junior reporter, I was listening to the foreign editor reading his tapes, the PA Reuters tapes coming in. Oh, there's a report of 10,000 dead in Bangladesh. Yawn. Oh, it's gone up a bit. It's 25,000. Yawn. Well, this seems to be a very bad flood. They're reckoning 50, 60,000 have been drowned in Bangladesh. Yawn. Of course, then it went up into the 100,000s or more, and they said, right, you better go. So off I went. Now, the BBC had a Delhi correspondent, and he was into Dhaka virtually the day after the first reports came through. I turned up 3 to 4 days later. I was in the bar of the Intercontinental Hotel in Dhaka, and an Indian came, Bangladeshi, was Pakistan, it was Pakistan, in East Pakistan then, of course, he came up to me, and he'd seen the television cameras come in, and he realized we were from ITN. I said, you know, I'm married to an English girl, I come from Southampton, you know, what you must be here. Because I was a bit bored by this, and I didn't want to talk to him. I had a long flight, I wanted a drink, and I wanted to start finding out what it was. So I was very distant, you know, kind of pushing away. And he said, of course, you're here for the floods. Yes, it's very difficult to cover these floods because they're so far away. Yes, yes, yes. He said, of course, I have a flying boat. What? Of course, my attitude changed completely. I couldn't have been more friendly and more interested in his house in Southampton and his English wife. And we flew off the next morning in his flying boat, scooped everybody because you could go anywhere in it. And the BBC still hadn't covered the story by the time I'd left. So, you know, that is the kind of luck that you have. But that is the kind of attitude that ITN has too. We've always been very daring, less so nowadays. No reason to be so daring nowadays. The agencies cover so much. But no, very exciting times, and my feet hardly touched the ground. In those early days, I was abroad 8 months of the year.
Start off though, you know, in your first jobs with ITN. Am I right in thinking that Biafra was your first big war?
My first foreign war, yes. You start off as a sub writing lead-ins for the newscaster, you know, 10, 15 seconds, just rewrites of PA, write a copy. Then you, in those days, you wrote scripts to cover what were silent camera stories. We had silent cameras in those days, as well as sound cameras, and you'd send a silent cameraman out to cover a road crash or a bus crash or whatever. People swimming on Christmas Day in the Serpentine. And they bring that silent footage back, it would be cut, and then you would write a script for a professional voice. An actor would come in and then read those words over those pictures. But if you had a broadcasting voice, as I assumed I had, they would then let you read your own scripts. It would save money anyway. It would save money bringing an actor in. So you'd read your own scripts on air. So the next logical step, of course, was then to become a reporter. If you could write a script, if you could read it properly, and you had a reasonably approachable face, then they gave you a chance of becoming a reporter. So I then became a reporter. Learned my trade from the camera crews, because there was no training colleges then. There were no university teaching you journalism or broadcast journalism. There's only one way you learnt, and that was from the camera crews, who were fairly hostile to reporters, because most of them had been recruited from the government British News, Movie Tone. They'd never worked with reporters before or directors before, so to be told what to do by some middle upstart half their age, you know, didn't please them. But if they took a liking to you and they realised that sooner or later they had to like you, they taught you your business. So you learnt from them. You learnt everything from them, from the crews. And then you waited for your first big foreign break. I'd had a few home scoops. The Torrey Canyon was one of them. But you waited for your first big foreign trip. I remember how jealous and how envious, green, I was watching these reporters going off to far-flung places, the Congo, Vietnam. Well, the one who was busiest at that time is a man called Alan Hart, and you really ought to talk to Alan Hart. He has been a sick man, but Alan Hart was the first of what I will politely call, and I don't mean to be sniping, the first of the showbiz reporters. A man who could entertain on screen. A man who could inject drama into a story where perhaps there was no drama. He would make even the most dullest story come alive. Mind you, having said that, I mean, he did reports of some pretty horrific places. He was in Aden, he was in Bukavu in the Congo, he went to Vietnam. But he was the one who first taught people like me that you mustn't just stand in front of a camera or just do a straight report. You've got to inject life, drama, make the viewer kind of sit up, you know. Even if sometimes you didn't have to do it because the drama was there. Sometimes you did, and he did it superbly well. So I think he was the first of all those of us who followed Alan Hart. Richard Lindley came in eventually. John Edwards was another one. Sandy Gall was of course another one. Reginald Bezenker used to do reporting. But there were only very few reporters then. I suppose when I joined ITN, there couldn't have been more. Jerry Seymour, I forgot D.L. Jerry, still a good buddy of mine. Jerry Seymour did some wonderful stuff. There must have been only about 8-9 reporters in ITN then. Tom St. John Barry was a reporter who did crime. So a very small group of reporters, an even smaller group that did foreign reporting. So I sat there always very envious. And you just waited for the break. You waited for guys to be sick or too long a lunch or already away. And I got my first break to go to Nigeria, the Nigerian Civil War. Started in, 67? And I went out, I remember the date precisely, it was August the 12th, 1968. It was the day that Soviet tanks rolled into Prague. And I remember being overjoyed that I was going off to Nigeria to cover my first war, and landing in Nigeria to learn from the BBC World Service that the tanks had rolled into Prague. I realized that I was no longer on the biggest story, and nor would I be for some time. But my brief was to confirm or deny reports that the Nigerian government had embarked on genocide against the Igbo, the Biafran. And we met a man called Adekunle, who was in charge of the astonishing name, the 3rd Marine Commando, Fred Karno's army really. And he was in Biafra, Eastern Province, and he gave us permission to go up the front line, and we followed a trail of destruction, slaughter, until we came to the man who was responsible, who was a young lieutenant. And as I say, on the way up, we came across villages that had been burned. We came across people who had had their hands tied behind their back and shot. that it was genocide, it was scorched earth policy. And while I was, we filmed this man, this young lieutenant, very handsome guy, and then we interviewed him, and while we were interviewing him, they brought out a captured Biafran, who protested he wasn't a Biafran. He said, I'm just looking for my family, but he obviously was a Biafran soldier. And I, showing my naivety, I said to him, I tried to placate him because he was hysterical. I said, look, and they, of course they spoke English, almost they do there. I said, you're perfectly safe, you mustn't worry, you're a prisoner of war, under the Geneva Convention, you're going to be all this rubbish, of course, in the middle of the, in the Nigerian bush. And then this lieutenant simply pulled up his rifle, an FM, even while I was talking to him, as close as I am to you, and just blew the man apart. He fired, I think, nine bullets into his chest, just blew his chest open. We got splattered in blood. Cameraman continued filming. And then, of course, I expected this lieutenant, realizing what he'd done, to turn the gun on us. But he didn't. And the reason, of course, I realized much later, was that he had no idea, being a fairly primitive guy himself, that what he had done was being recorded on television and that would then be seen by the world. So he was quite proud. He gave me his name, and I managed to smuggle that film out back to London. It was shown on television. We were still in Nigeria, of course.
How do you get footage like that? Presumably you were in the back of Beyond.
Well, what I did, I left the crew there. I had to leave the crew there because I disappeared during the night. But had we all disappeared, the alert would have gone out and we'd have been stopped. So I had to leave the crew there. I then smuggled myself aboard an airplane taking the wounded back to Lagos. And in Lagos, I then gave it to a British Overseas Airways captain, BOAC captain at the time, who flew it to London, and of course I'd managed to contact London from Lagos and told them, couldn't tell them what was on it, but I told them there was some sensational stuff. And of course it was delivered to ITN, or ITN picked it up from the airport. Of course then it was shown that same night, and that the Nigerian embassy in London of course alerted Lagos, Lagos alerted Port Harcourt where we were. We were then arrested by this man, Adekunle, who threatened to whip us and shave our heads. he realized, of course, he couldn't. I had to then identify this lieutenant, and he was court-martialed, and he was then shot, tied up at a tree, blindfolded, and executed. When I got back to, we were then allowed to go. But just as we were leaving Lagos Airport on this BOEC BC-10, some military, Nigerian military, boarded the plane and told us to get off. We were to witness the execution of this man that we had condemned. And we said, no, thank you. But they said the plane wouldn't be allowed to leave unless we did get off. But thank God the British Airways captain said he was in charge of the plane, and there would be a major diplomatic incident if they did not leave the plane immediately. And his bravado won, and they got off. When I got back to London, I was met by our deputy editor, Don Horobin, who was white-faced, and he never, ever met journalists atop planes. And he said, did you cover the execution? And I thought, oh, God, I made a mistake, you know. He should have made me, I should have covered it. And I said, no. And he said, thank God. I couldn't make out why. He'd received a report over PA that a British television crew had filmed the execution of this lieutenant. But just as the rifles had been brought up for the by the firing squad, the cameraman called out, stop, stop, hold it, battery's flat. Camera battery had gone flat. So the firing squad were held in position and this poor man was waiting tied up to a tree to be executed, while the cameraman changed his battery And then he said, okay, and they shot him. And it was a BBC crew. And the reporter is still alive today. The cameraman is dead. But of course, ITN thought that it was us. And can you imagine the furore that would have followed? I mean, we got into enough trouble with the press anyway. They accused me of being responsible for the Ibo's death because, you know, we were up there filming. And so there was a, you know, how the press are, dog eats dog. But had we actually then filmed the man's execution, you know, that would have been... So thank God I didn't. But there you are. That was my first story, my very first foreign story.
Would you have done that if you had been there?
No, we refused. No, they told us to film it, and we said we would not. We would not. That happened many, many years later in Dhaka at the end of the war in East Pakistan, when East Pakistan became Bangladesh. 19... Oh dear, you'll have to check the date there. 71, is it? 70... When some of the East Pakistan soldiers and politicians were rounded up by the Bangladeshis and taken to the stadium, and in front of a crowd of 20,000 had their heads chopped off. And we were invited to come along to see it, and we refused. One man didn't. He went and photographed it, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for doing it, but all the television crews refused to. Anyway, that's jumping ahead.
Yes, I know. It would be interesting to ask you more about that. But there must be these sort of occasions when, you know, there are dilemmas whether to film or...
Yes, well, when you go to these seminars, the standard question is the disaster view is, imagine you arrived on an island where there is a civil war, and a man comes to you he has a petrol can in one hand and a cigarette lighter in the other, and he tells you he's going to set fire to himself in protest. What do you do? Do you film him or do you stop him? You see, that is your dilemma. And there is no answer to that, I mean, except a glib one, which I invariably use. I say, well, can't you make it 10 men with 10 petrol cans and 10 lighters, and then I can't do anything about it but film. You see, well, that's the easy answer, right?
But I suppose it's your conscience, is it, or, you know, your moral standards that direct in situations like that?
Well, I suppose that's what you like to think, but I think it's more of a practical hesitation. You know, if I do this, what is going to be, one, the editor's response, and two, what is going to be the public response? Or maybe it's the other way around. If I do this, what will the viewers think of me? Will they be on my side or will they not? If they're not on my side, then I'm going to become very unpopular with them. Then my job is in jeopardy. So I think that you know, to be quite honest with you, there's as much a practical reservation as a moral one. Sometimes it is quite wrong. But, you know, I think our first rule always has to be film it if it is possible to film. Film it if you're not putting somebody's life at risk. Film it because it doesn't have to be used if greater wisdom at the other end of the operation forbids it. See, when that Ibo was shot, Geoffrey Cox was in a lot of... had a dilemma. Should he use it because it was so horrific? Or should he use it because he was obliged to, and that was part of the story, to show that this was happening over there? Because after it happened, and after that man was court-martialed and executed, General Gowon, who was president of Nigeria at the time, then laid down certain rules, and he was a good man, and those rules were obeyed. And as far as we can gather from independent sources, the genocide has stopped.
So your intervention, really?
Well, we like to think that. It certainly helps me to think that. And I believe it to be true, because we heard this from Ibo's afterwards, that after that was transmitted, there were new ground rules. And the slaughter of civilians stopped.
Could I go back, Michael, to your first arrival? And this chap you mentioned, Colonel, was it Adekunle?
Adekunle.
Adekunle. Could you tell us something about him?
Adekunle, Benjamin Adekunle, that's A-D-E-K-U-N-L-E, Adekunle. Sandhurst trained, a general, a young man, couldn't be more than 35, like so many Nigerian officers, spoke with a terribly, terribly, you know, upper-class English accent. An absolute bastard. Used to whip his men, pistol whip them, and also hit them with their own rifles. He once said to me that he didn't have the luxury of discipline, the English way. To make a soldier fight, he had to be terrified, not of the enemy, but more of him. And that was how he ruled, by terror. I went to one evening, I went with the crew to his house and in Lagos, nice house, as you'd expect, and he gave us dinner, and then all of a sudden he reached into his there was a bowl of fruit or flowers, and pulled out a pistol and held it to my head, and then he clicked. Of course, I went absolutely white, and he laughed and said I was the whitest white man he'd ever seen. He said, "I'm doing," and of course, is this your party trick? He said, "No." He said, "There are guns all over this house." He said, "I have to be very careful of security," and he said, "Even my weighty head would kill me if he had a chance. I can't take any risks." He said. So that was his little joke about guns everywhere. Then. When we left, I said, "Well, you know, it's a jolly good job that, for my sake, that chamber was empty." He said, "Oh, no, the gun is full. Only one chamber was empty," he said. And he fired into the ceiling, blew a hole in the ceiling. So that was his little, I'm glad he got his chambers, didn't get his chambers mixed up. But that was him. That he was a vicious, vicious man. And they called him the Black Scorpion. And all his troops had a little cutout of a black scorpion on their tunics. I think when the war ended, he went into the transport business, became a millionaire.
This evidence of genocide, could you tell me about this? This is when you went with his third...
the third Marine Commando, yes. We went from Port Harcourt up towards Oweri. O-W-E-R-R-I, Oweri. That was the front. And literally, within the day, we were coming across villages that had been either grenaded or set on fire. And we came across bodies in the bush, been just shot in the back of the head. So there was a trail of destruction, civilian destruction, all the way up. And when we got to Macaulay, Lieutenant Macaulay, there he was, stripped to the waist, wearing sandals, and he had a bullwhip, and he was whipping his men. And they were just going into villages and, you know, just machine gunning the house and seeing if there's anybody inside. It was a very brutal war, but then, you know, the Nigerians are quite a brutal people.
This word genocide, you mm-hmm. know, it was genocide rather than massacres.
Well, what is it? To my mind, it's the same thing. If you want to wipe out a population, that's genocide. And they wanted to wipe out the Igbo. And they were pretty good at it. We, when I later went into Biafra, I mean, to go from Nigeria proper into the new so-called Republic of Biafra, you could simply cross the road, but of course that wasn't possible. You had to go back to London or Lisbon and then fly in and come through Sao Tome or Fernando Po, and then land at this famous Yuli airstrip, which is what we did a month later. So within a month, I'd gone from, you know, the federal side fighting the Biafrans to the Biafran side fighting the Federals, and we went to a place called Amahia.
This Yuli airstrip, that would have been, would that have been the only one that Biafra had?
It's the only one, yes.
Could you describe that, what it was like?
Yuli was just a road. It was just a rather good road, and a tarmac road. And during the day, it looked like a road. But at night, and it was any time you could go in at night because of the Nigerian Air Force patrols, you went in these big DC-4s. And then they would have what we used to call the Air Force goosenecks, which is just a bucket with a spout. Along the end of the spout was a wick. It was full of paraffin, and you lit it, and you place it along the edge of the road. Then it became more sophisticated when they put landing lights down. So when they heard one of these aircraft coming in, they would turn the lights on. It would land quickly, and they'd turn the lights out again. So when we came in, you could see the lights, but as soon as you heard the wheels hit the tarmac, the lights would go out. So there you are, hurtling along, just seeing trees by in total darkness. But that was the only way they could operate. Otherwise, these Nigerian Air Force MiGs would be circling, because once they saw, they would come down and blow the aircraft up, which they managed to do on a few occasions. It was horrific, most horrific flight I've ever had. We had a very narrow escape there. We were coming in, we were filming with Caritas, the Catholic aid organization, and Father Tony Byrne was in charge there. And in a place called Sao Tome, which is on the coast of Baita Biafra, an old Portuguese island. And we came across an English pilot called Scott. I think it was John Scott. And it was ideal for us to do a story about an Englishman flying in this air, on this airlift. And he was quite happy for us to do it. And we were going to get him loading up and then, you know, filming in the cockpit and then filming at the other end, do an interview with him, make a nice story. And as we were about to board this plane, we were told we couldn't get on. I forget whether it was Tony Byrne, but somebody said, no, you can't go on this one, you must go on another one. And we were very uptight about it. But anyway, we couldn't argue. So we went on a later plane, which was just as well, because when John Scott came in to land, he misjudged it and hit the trees and blew up, and we would have been on it. We later discovered that he was actually carrying arms. I don't think he knew that, but they did smuggle in arms with the aid planes. The only way they could get their arms in. And, of course, it would not have done for journalists to have seen these arms on board. Not that it would have mattered, because we'd have been dead along with Tony Scott. And he's buried in or was buried. All the pilots who died were buried by the side of the Yuli airstrip in a small grave. At the end of the war, that was bulldozed over. But now they're hoping to erect a small, simple monument to all the pilots who died in that airlift.
They
came from everywhere. Americans, Canadians, Brits, all kinds.
Were they sort of mercenaries?
All mercenaries. Oh, I think they were getting $200 a flight, which US, which was a lot of money in those days. They earned a lot of cash, but then they did earn it. On the morning of that, when Scott crashed, it was reported on the BBC that a airlift plane going into Yuli airstrip, captained by an Englishman, John Scott, and three others had died. And of course, I'd already alerted my office that we were going to go in on John Scott's plane, and we were doing this story, so they assumed that we were it. And for about 2 days, ITN and my wife, Diana, assumed that we were dead. It was only when I managed to get to a radio station that I told ITN that we were not dead.